Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
It's 4 o'clock in New York on another huge and bonkers news day. An announcement today from the New York Attorney General, Tish James, that is nothing short of a bombshell. The New York AG announcing a civil suit that could be potentially devastating to the fortunes of the Trump family and filing a criminal referral to federal prosecutors as well as to the IRS. At a press conference today, Tish James accused the Trump family and the Trump business, the Trump org, of engaging in rampant and systemic bank, tax, and insurance fraud for decades, of manipulating the worth of their properties to deceive lenders, insurance companies, and government authorities to reap billions of dollars in financial gain. Here's some of what she said.
The pattern of fraud and deception that was used by Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization for their own financial benefit is astounding. Inflating the values of assets by whatever means necessary to increase Mr. Trump's purported net worth. And then that net worth was used to further enhance his financial standing, intentionally misrepresenting his financials to obtain incredible economic benefit. It was a scheme that by its very nature became more profitable over time. And it is all in stark violation of the law.
The lawsuit, which seeks to bar the Trumps from doing business in New York, as well as to fine them to the tune of $250 million, reads in part, quote, "The number of grossly inflated asset values is staggering, affecting most, if not all, of the real estate holdings in any given year. All told, Trump, the Trump org, and the other defendants, as part of a repeated pattern and common scheme, derive more than 200 false and misleading valuations of assets." The AG's office also making it clear that the scheme, which James describes as astounding, was directed from the tippy top of the organization. Once again, from the lawsuit, quote, "These acts of fraud and misrepresentation were approved at the highest levels of the Trump org, including by Trump himself. In a statement, attorneys for Donald Trump and the Trump org deny any wrongdoing and accuse Tish James of blah, 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 playing politics." It's actually an allegation that has already been before a federal court and rejected. It happened last December. A district court judge dismissed a lawsuit by Trump seeking to block Tish James' investigation and rejecting Trump's claims that the probe was politically motivated. For her part, James said that her lawsuit and the criminal referral she is making to the IRS and the Justice Department is simply about holding Donald Trump and his family to the same standard as every American.
Claiming you have money that you do not have does not amount to the art of the deal. It's the art of the steal.
And that is where we begin today with some of our most favorite reporters and friends. With me at the table, again, NBC News Investigations correspondent Tom Winter. Plus, we have Neil Katyal joining us, former acting solicitor general, now a Georgetown law professor and MSNBC legal analyst. Also, the great Suzanne Craig is here, New York Times investigative reporter whose work covering Trump's finances has earned her and her colleagues a Pulitzer Prize. And David Farenthold is also here. He's also at the New York Times now, an investigative reporter and also a Pulitzer Prize winner when he was at the Washington Post for his reporting on Trump's charitable giving, both of them MSNBC contributors. Tom Winter, I start with you. What leaps out?
A couple of different things. First off, the scope of this, that it continued up until 2020 when Trump, by that point, had to, according to the Attorney General's office, had to know that he was under investigation, or at least questions were well swirling about what was going on in his world. And yet that, according to the Attorney General, didn't lead them to step off the gas, that they kept going with some of these evaluations that she now questioned. So I think that that's interesting, number one. Number two,
that he was committing fraud while he was president.
While apparently he was under investigation. investigation. And so I think that that is, those are two kind of glaring points, according to the Attorney General's office. Another thing that sticks out, I mean, you mentioned the potential $250 million disgorgement, obviously the potential for a lifetime ban of the Trumps, not just the former president running his company, but this idea, and it's an issue that we're really starting to dig into from a reporting standpoint, which is, what is the future of Donald Trump just from a financial standpoint and his family? I mean, the other penalty here that effectively would bar him from getting any sort of new loan in for any bank that's registered with the New York State Department of Finance, how far does that go? He's already, as we've previously reported in the NBC News investigative unit, he's already up against it on a number of loans, and some loans are starting to come due. And so he might need to roll those over, get additional financing. What does that mean going forward? That could certainly impact his properties. Is he going to get to a point here where he's going to have to really start selling some things off just to be able to pay the bills, so to speak, as it relates to this case? So those are certainly things that, that jumped off. I know you want to get into it. Certainly the criminal referrals, I think everybody paid a lot of attention to this morning, because that may indicate that there's more or new information potentially for federal prosecutors to look at.
David Farenthold, your first reactions to what you heard from the AG and what you've read in her lawsuit.
Well, this may just be me, but the thing that I was struck by was, we've all, journalists, have been looking for a long time at these statements of financial condition, which were basically Trump's brag sheets about his finances, to look for places where he might have misled lenders or insurers. And we thought we found a lot, but the AG found so much more. She mentioned more than 20 properties, more than 200 examples, that it touched even things like, how many square feet is the apartment where Trump lives in Trump Tower? According to her, every little piece of this was exaggerated or outright invented. So even I, who looked at these things for a long time, was surprised at how she'd found falsehoods and exaggerations basically everywhere and every year in these sheets.
Suzanne, she had access to an amount of material that seemed to swell. The Supreme Court opened up her access to some of those documents. Her ongoing investigation opened up even more. And I wonder your reaction, having, as David said, and Tom as well, having investigated some of these open questions for a long time, what do you make of what you saw in this lawsuit today?
Well, I was just reading it before I came on air, and David's comments do resonate, because one of the things I was just, you know, wishing that we've had during our investigations, you know, the accountant, Donald Bender, was interviewed. They have so much information. And he's saying, look, I didn't get this information. They either didn't send it to me or I got other information. And it just shows, and, you know, the accounting firm that Donald Trump was using has severed ties with him. But just the depth of information that they had and the people that they were able to interview, it was very rich in reading it. I'm still not done. And we'll probably go through it several more times tonight. But just every page was like, wow, this is incredible. You know, you're just looking at, one of the things I'm always interested in is their charitable donations, and just looking at the allegations. And, you know, they've been out there that they would put very high valuations on their charitable donations, these land donations that they had, because then they would get a great tax break. A lot more detail about things like that that we have wondered about, that have been in the public purview, but just a lot more underlying information there.
So, Neil, I have always tried to understand Trump through the patterns. And my sort of take on him after 6 years of covering now is that they're not new moves, they're just new grifts. And so to me, what I saw in some of the documents that are cited is he lied to his accountant, who then would vouch for valuations, the same way he lied to Christina Robb about the Mar-a-Lago classified documents. The pattern is always the same. This was another exhibit of that pattern.
100%, Nicole. So this new lawsuit is basically alleging that Donald Trump ignored outside experts and advice, that he inflated his personal value, and he roped his family and friends into supporting the fraud. And, you know, say what you will, Donald Trump ran his business the way he ran the country. And you're absolutely right. It's pattern after pattern. Now, to be sure, this is a civil lawsuit. So if it's successful, as I suspect it will be, it won't land Donald Trump in prison. There are criminal implications that we can talk about in a minute. But I think Tom Winter is exactly right to say that this really does put a huge financial, it puts him at huge financial risk, with a lifetime ban on the Trump Organization, loans being called involved in all sorts of things. I guess on the other hand, the New York Attorney General is also seeking to bar the Trump family from acquiring real estate for the next 5 years. And given Trump's average return on investment, she might be doing him a favor. I don't know. But you know, to me, what really stood out is the devastating range in this complaint. 200 examples over 222 pages, and it feels ironclad. I mean, remember that Alan Weisselberg, who was Trump's CFO, has already pled guilty to these offenses. 15 different felonies he pled to. 15 felonies, and somehow I don't think that Alan Weisselberg is the one who committed the most crimes here.
So a former prosecutor described the evidence that she's marshaled to me as being presented in, quote, mind-numbing detail. And he said that the conduct spans 10 years and a pattern that we've been talking about over valuations that is kind of undeniable. And I want to turn to what the criminal investigation would look like. SDNY obviously had access to Michael Cohen, but the document production and what is in her complaint, I don't see Michael Cohen's name anywhere. I mean, clearly, if he was the match that started this, what has been filled out is you know, hundreds of pages now of evidence based on documents that are indisputable.
I mean, already on the public docket are 10 years of the former president's personal financial statements, or at least his presentation of his wealth. And when you start to go through, and I'm there with Suzanne, I mean, it's going to be another, you know, a day or two, I think, of reading through this thing before it all sinks in. You see email exchanges. I mean, paragraph to paragraph, point to point, where they're pointing out, okay, this person says to do this, this person says to do that. So the civil complaint, if it's to be believed, is built on top of kind of real-time contemporaneous communications and notes about exactly what the business was doing or trying to do at the moment it was trying to do that. Are these email messages new? Are they new types of evidence that they can hand over to the Southern District or the IRS Criminal Division? And if so, is it going to be just a strict, you know, hey, here you go, and hand it over to them? Or is it going to be the type of thing where they say, you know, here's our roadmap and you guys can, you know, go with your own federal grand jury subpoenas? So there's probably a couple of different ways that they could go with it, but it certainly would allow them the path to move forward if there's, and this is the big, you know, kind of the big turning point here. One, does it violate federal law in statute? That's more of a Neil question than a Tom question. And then the second thing is, you know, this is a civil case versus a criminal case, and the bar is higher in a criminal case. That's just known, and I know you know that. So when you look at this in totality, are they going to be able to tie that all together? I still think, though, the immediate threat for the president, who's facing an ongoing criminal investigation involving classified documents that we've talked about a lot this week, the idea and prospect of him losing his business, his legacy, his kids' business, their legacy, I think compounded with these other investigations, even if his political funds are helping to support that defense effort,
right,
still is really starting to become an anvil over him as far as moving forward and maybe his calculus. Then that becomes a political calculus. That's much more your world than mine.
They're all this. I mean, to your point, they're totally, you can't separate one from the other, because right, the fervor on the politics, the taking on the QAnon people, is about losing his legacy and his business and his family fortune.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's starting to look at some chips that are pretty well stacked against him. He got no favors in front of the special master yesterday. And so he's looking at a situation where he's fighting a lot of legal battles on all fronts. I know people say, well, you guys have been talking about investigations for years. You're talking about every single development. First things first, we talk about developments involving the current or former president of the United States, because those are huge developments. And so the reporting that David's done, Suzanne's done, has been incredibly important over the years, just to understand the person who was at the time running or the president of the United States. Number two, no guarantees are made as far as any sort of investigations bearing fruit from an indictment or a civil standpoint. Analysts are free to make those judgments. That's what they're paid to do. They have the expertise to do it. Finally, when you look at all of these investigations now that we have been talking about, we've been talking about this one today in particular for years, they're all starting to come to a point, and they're all starting to come to a conclusion, and they're not concluding with a, we can't really bring a case. They're not concluding with a, we're not going to sue. They're concluding with, we're suing. They're concluding with, mm-hmm. we're getting a search warrant for the president's, yeah. former president's residence. So these, all these things are starting to come together in a way that points for significant legal trouble on the horizon, not just political trouble because, oh, special counsel Mueller brought somebody else in today to talk to. No, no, no. He's bringing in people, or these people are bringing in people and are actually making cases directly against the now former president of the United States. I think that's a point that shouldn't be lost in all this.
I mean, it's a pretty powerful point coming from you, Tom Mandar. I know you have to go. I know you develop a twitch if you have to sit on TV and not dive into the documents themselves. So I'm going to let you go. But just one more. I mean, what has changed, though, is the evidence and the access to the evidence. And this case is right. all on paper. This is all about what she saw. It's about, you know, and I just want to put up one before you go, because it's a perfect example. This is something that everyone can understand as illegal, cheating, and fraudulent. This is Tish James on how he lied about how much his apartment was worth.
Mr. Trump represented that his apartment spanned more than 30,000 square feet, which was the basis for valuing the apartment. In reality, the apartment had an area of less than 11,000 square feet, something that Mr. Trump was well aware of. And based on that inflated square footage, the value of the apartment in 2015 and 2016 was $327 million. To this date, no apartment in New York City has ever sold for close to that amount. Tripling the size of the apartment for purposes of the valuation was intentional and deliberate fraud, not an honest mistake.
And then we've got from the lawsuit itself, this is the power, I guess, of what you're describing, the legal process sort of combing through its witnesses, including Donald Trump. So when asked about the scheme she just described there, he invoked his Fifth Amendment privilege. The question, you are aware that from 2012 through 2016, the value of your triplex apartment in Trump Tower was calculated by multiplying 30,000 square feet times the price per square foot. Is that right? Same answer. He takes the Fifth. And you personally directed the use of 30,000 square feet in valuing your apartment for the statement of financial condition. Same answer. He takes the Fifth. The 30,000 square foot figure is false. Is that right? Same answer. When you directed the use of that square footage to value your triplex, you knew that the 30,000 square foot figure was false. Takes the Fifth. So she's got the lie. She's got Trump.
Well, and she also has a deposition, and that deposition and those comments, if this does go to a jury trial, is something that is admissible. So what you just did is presumably what a prosecutor might do in a year, 2 years time from now in presenting this going forward. This is not a case based on what we've been told today by the attorney general. We're relying on Michael Cohen's statement, Stormy Daniels' statement. Anybody's statement. We're relying on, we have the president actually answering questions in front of a live questioner, not somebody who submitted him written questions. And we have documents, financials, and math that's occurring here. Undoubtedly, the Trump side, and they already are tweeting about it, questioning the math here.
He doesn't get to tweet. They're doing something
else. That's a good point.
Social.
His children are tweeting about this. Mm. But when you look at this, it is a very different case than some of the actions that have been brought before or some of the investigations that have been brought before.
Tom Winter, thank you so much for your reporting. You are now free to go report. I want to play for you something, David Farenthold, that caught my attention. It's a question from Josh Gerstein to Attorney General Tish James.
Do they just not check anything that people tell them, or they presumed it was true, or did they have hints that these things were not true, that they were being told? And what does it tell you about those institutions that they would take his word for it?
So let me just say, with respect to Mazars indicated on the statement of financial condition that they did not certify and they did not audit these statements. That does not absolve Mr. Trump of submitting accurate information. Two, with respect to Cushman Wakefield, there is an ongoing investigation into Cushman Wakefield. And then lastly, with respect to Deutsche Bank, we're in conversations with Deutsche Bank. They have been cooperating with our office.
I mean, what she pulls the curtain back on, David Farenthold, is a very far-ranging investigation that has checked all the boxes of any potential participants in the fraud.
Yeah, this is important here. One of the questions that they're going to have to answer in this case is, you know, well, this is real estate. Everybody fudges the numbers. Everybody says their properties are the greatest. So how do you draw a line that separates just sort of normal puffery from fraud? And I think the way they're going to try to do it is by showing that, look, they did talk to experts. They did talk to appraisers. They talked to people, you know, they had access to real people who saw this from an objective point of view and told them their numbers were totally wrong, not even in the same ballpark. And then knowing the right answer or knowing the range of the right answer, they chose to ignore it. I think that will go towards showing the kind of intent they would need to prove to show that this was not just an honest mistake or sort of normal real estate flimflam, but something far beyond that that moved into the realm of fraud.
Suzanne, we learned from your reporting that flimflam was not the family way. It was this sprawling and audacious pattern of fraud passed down from the father.
Right. As Tom Winter was talking, I was thinking about it. What we're seeing here is such a pattern, whether it's this case that we're talking about, the civil case today, or the one, the criminal case against the Trump Organization that's going to trial in October. It's just case after case after case where they just are really either, you know, they're pushing the line or they're moving it right into illegal behavior. You think about the criminal case that's going forward where Alan Weisselberg has already entered, you know, guilty pleas on it. There he was, they had just incident after incident where, you know, he would take, you know, tuition or a car, and those are taxable benefits, and they were never recorded as that. And then you look at that and you look at today's case, and it's just a pattern of behavior that is, it's really alarming. We uncovered it in our reporting, and well, we're seeing it play out in the legal arena, and it's just it's something, because we've been, you know, talking about it for a long time, but it never can't really cease to sort of shock you when you see it.
So, Neil, I gauge how shocked I'm going to feel by how shocked people, reporters like Tom and David and Suzanne feel. And when they're shocked by the criminal sort of behavior around finances, for me, it elevates the story and it elevates the evidence she's marshaled. So I guess my question for you, Neil, is why isn't there a criminal prosecution already underway by SDNY?
Well, there may be an investigation. We don't know. Today in the complaint on page 2, the New York Attorney General isolated a list of federal crimes that she thought were potentially violated. And I think the thing that this lawsuit did was collect all the reporting from our friends on this show, but then add to it all the evidence from the accountants, the evidence from the CFO and others. And it's a it's a case based on a huge amount of paperwork, which is unlike a lot of the other investigations that Trump has faced, where his allies like Kash Patel can just make up stories to protect him. This is based on cold facts in paperwork that is under the Trump Organization. I think Donald Trump probably at this point wishes he could flush some of those financial statements down the toilet right now. There's a big difference between what's going on in this attorney general suit and a criminal one. And one part of it is the burden of proof, which in a criminal case is beyond a reasonable doubt, a very high standard that the prosecution has to show for all sorts of good reasons before you can put someone in jail. But in a civil case is just a preponderance of the evidence, 51% or something like that. As I say, this New York one is a civil case. So the standard of proof is lower. But the other piece about it is all of these times that Donald Trump and his family took the Fifth Amendment, hundreds of times in the New York Attorney General's investigation. In a criminal case, because of our Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, you can't draw any sort of inference when someone takes the Fifth Amendment. But in the civil case, you can. So this New York case is actually a much easier case because the jury can be shown exactly, Nicole, what you just put on the screen, where Trump refused to answer question after question about these property values. And the jury is going to be told by the judge, you can infer from the fact that he's not trying to say he's innocent and dispute this, that he isn't. So it's a huge difference. And so if you're a prosecutor, you might actually want to start and let that civil lawsuit unfold first and then bring the criminal case later. It seems like a good criminal case at this point based on what I'm seeing in the complaint.
All right, we're going to continue to dig into this part of the story. Tish James today name-checked Michael Cohen, or at least called him out for his role in this, sparking or being the genesis of the investigation. We'll show you some of what he had testified to publicly next. Plus, the ex-president's problems, of course, do not start and stop with Letitia James. The January 6th Congressional Committee will hold another public hearing 1 week from today. We'll look at all the things that have changed in this country since we last heard from them in a public way, including a huge ramp up of the Justice Department's parallel probe into January 6th, and trying to isolate another world leader on the world stage, President Biden this morning, on the dangerous aggression coming from Russia's Vladimir Putin, who today indicated or doubled down on threats of using nuclear weapons. We'll talk about all that when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
It was my experience that Mr. Trump inflated his total assets when it served his purposes, such as trying to be listed amongst the wealthiest people in Forbes, and deflated his assets to reduce his real estate taxes.
But to your knowledge, did the president ever provide inflated assets to a bank in order to help him obtain a loan?
These documents and others were provided to Deutsche Bank on one occasion where I was with them in our attempt to obtain money so that we can put a bid on the Buffalo Bills.
That moment right there may ultimately have led to today's bombshell announcement from Tish James. That was Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, at a House hearing back in 2019, alleging that Donald Trump routinely manipulated the value of his assets and then deflated them when it served him. We're back with Neil, Suzanne, and David. Neil, what happens next in the civil suit? What is the next step?
Well, I suspect that Trump will file some sort of motion to dismiss, saying that, you know, these allegations aren't proven. So he'll write a long brief if he can find a lawyer to write it for him. And then the government will respond in their brief, and then there'll be an oral argument on this. That can take a long time. Civil litigation moves fairly slowly. So this isn't something that we should expect is going to be done with any rapid speed. And of course, Trump's whole playbook is always delay, delay, delay. So when you ask me what's the first thing Trump's going, what's going to happen next, I'm sure it's going to be some motion for delay, as Trump always files those.
Neil, let me just put up what is alleged in the lawsuit again. I mean, so he represented Mar-a-Lago's value at $739 million. I've driven by. I don't know much about mansions, but that sounds like a really, really expensive mansion. And it turns out the real value is $75 million. It's like not even close. So, I mean, do you say like, oh, I missed a column? I mean, and the same thing with Park Avenue. He said it was $135 million. It's actually $84 million. He said Trump Seven Springs was worth $291 million. It's not even close. It's worth $56 million. I mean, what is the innocent explanation for such flagrant lying?
Well, I mean, I suppose with Mar-a-Lago, he can say it was worth $739 million once you count the street value of all the classified information that was there that he could sell off to other countries or something. You know, I don't think that it's going to be easy for him. So I don't think the defense is going to be twofold, I suspect. One is, oh, he had nothing to do with it. That was his people, his accountants, this and that and the other. And that's why I think that language you pointed to from Tish James's statement today about Donald Trump personally orchestrating this stuff, that this came from the top, is going to be so important. But nonetheless, that is going to be, you know, a big argument. The other big argument was teed up by the Josh Gerstein question, which is everyone is puffing in real estate. And, you know, there were very sophisticated financial, you know, entities on the other side, like Deutsche Bank and the like. And if they didn't see anything wrong, isn't this just kind of industry standard? And I think, you know, maybe a few dollars here or there may be industry standard, but going from, as you say, a $75 million property to a $739 million property in Mar-a-Lago, or saying that your apartment is 30,000 square feet when it's 11,000 square feet, and representing it to be the, you know, the most expensive real estate sale ever in the history of New York City by far, you know, at some point it doesn't pass a smell test. And both for civil and criminal, these are really easy things for a jury to understand. This isn't complicated stuff. People get it. And so if I'm Trump right now, I'm feeling incredibly worried, not just about the civil lawsuit, but that the civil one is going to mature and flower into a criminal one as well.
Now, Katyal, I know you have to leave us. Thank you for spending time with us today. David Farenthold, my question for you, you know, in your body of reporting, and Suzanne's as well, Trump isn't just in the room. He is making all the calls. He's the quarterback in everything. He picks his walk-up music at his rallies, which is why it's hard for his staff to walk away from the small stuff, because he is obsessed with the small stuff. He didn't like certain candidates for cabinet jobs because of the way they look. So putting him in the room feels like an easy thing to do. How difficult does that make the efforts to defend this flagrant fraud?
Well, his layer of protection has typically been that he doesn't use email. So there's no written paper trail of him saying do this or do that. And you'd have to find somebody from this very small circle of people, which from which only Michael Cohen has ever left, to say that, you know, he told me verbally to do this. That's why I think the charges against Trump's children and the emails that they sent is so interesting, because they do use email and they're in there in this complaint using email. And so the question would be, well, if Trump didn't say it, well, now I see Ivanka, Eric, Don Jr., issuing these orders over email. Did they do it on their own? If not, you sort of have to choose one or the other. If they're acting on their own, then they have the responsibility. And if they're not, then their father has responsibility. I think that's why she's included evidence from them and included them in this suit, because you can't sort of have one without the other. You know, somebody's taking responsibility, so which Trump is going to take that fall?
It is so interesting, Suzanne, that the kids are in the lawsuit, because a normal dynamic, people go down to protect their kids. This is not that. This is not normal. And we know from Don Jr.'s email, you know, when offered Oppo from the Russians about Hillary Clinton, quote, if it's what you say it is, I love it, end quote. What do you think is in this trove of emails from the kids?
Well, I think there's a lot of back and forth between different, whether there's some from people who've done appraisals, but you're seeing the kids were each had their own discrete area, and you're seeing emails where they're going back and forth about an appraisal. You know, Eric Trump was very involved with Seven Springs. He comes into it there about the appraisal that was done for the land, a charitable donation there. And I think that's what you're going to see. And they all had their sort of discrete area. So you see them across the lawsuit touching very different areas.
David, what if you sort of dive through, you know, everything that was introduced today by this lawsuit and the copious amount of paper that she's marshaled to file this lawsuit? Where does your sort of line of questions, where do you go in your head in terms of what you want to know next?
Well, I guess I want to know more about how they establish that, you know, how they connect the dots to Trump, how they overcome those two defenses we talked about earlier. A, you know, we don't have any of Trump's emails in here because he doesn't use email. And how do you overcome the it's just real estate, you know, everything's fair in real estate? How do you overcome those defenses? And I think that they will show that they will overcome those by saying, look, he lied to the people who then represented himself to the world. He lied to his accountants. He lied to his appraisers. And also that, you know, within the puffery of these appraisals, there were specific facts that weren't exaggerated, that weren't sort of guesswork, that were wrong. He said he could develop X number of lots when really the number was half of that. He said he had the right to develop Mar-a-Lago into homes when he actually had given that up long ago. If there's specific false facts that underlie those bigger numbers, and it's a lot harder to defend those numbers as just like, well, I took an optimistic guess. You know, you can't sue me for that.
All right, David Farenthold, thank you so much for being part of our coverage. We have roped Suzanne Craig into sticking around a little bit longer. She stays with us. For Donald Trump and the world to hear today out loud, that he's a liar and that he's not worth nearly the amount of money he says he's worth is something that Donald Trump has sought to avoid almost more than anything else for years and years and years. Our next guest knows this all too well. Tim O'Brien joins the conversation in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere.
My name's Donald Trump, and I'm the largest real estate developer in New York. I own buildings all over the place, model agencies, the Miss Universe pageant, jetliners, golf courses, casinos, and private resorts like Mar-a-Lago, one of the most spectacular estates anywhere in the world. It's doing great. Everybody's talking about the building. They love it. It's become the favored place in Hawaii. Part of the beauty of me is that I'm very rich. I'm really rich. I'm proud of my net worth. I've done an amazing job. I ventured into Manhattan and did a lot of great deals. And now I'm building all over the world. And I love what I'm doing.
Let me be perfectly honest. I know that makes most of you want to throw up in your mouth, but it's how he became president. His supporters loved all that stuff. And it turns out, we learned today, it was all a lie. It's the moment he hoped would never, ever, ever, ever happen. A lawsuit directly targeting his empire. The lie he created mostly for TV. An entire TV show, Empire, was built on it. Became the foundation for the big lies he'd tell as our country's president and commander-in-chief. Joining Suzanne Craig, let's bring in former U.S. Attorney and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Harry Lipman. Tim O'Brien also joins us, Senior Executive Editor for Bloomberg Opinion and an MSNBC contributor. Tim writes in a new column about Trump's business now finally facing a serious reckoning thanks to his penchant for inflating his wealth, his achievements, and his abilities. Tim, I want to start with your piece. Tish James's lawsuit won't land the Trumps in prison. Only criminal convictions could do that. But it seeks to bar the Trumps from running a business in New York State and may unravel the Trump org. Trump brought the family business in Manhattan and the spotlight. Now, for the second time in his career, he has put the family's business legacy on the precipice. Trash canning the New York remnants of what his father started about a century ago will weigh on Trump, regardless of what he says about it.
Yeah, you know, he's journalists and his business competitors, Nicole, have known for years that all of his carnivalesque behavior involves sometimes lies, sometimes exaggerations, but little of what he said about his business dealings in Manhattan were true. You know, the clip that you played from The Apprentice in which he says he's the biggest real estate developer in Manhattan, he has never been, either by the, you know, the value of what he owned or the scale and scope of what he owned. The difference is, though, that kind of behavior never exposed him to existential legal consequences. And this is the first time that I think his business dealings have come under the legal scope with this kind of precision and with the potential that the family business will effectively end in New York State. I think Tish James has a hurdle here in front of her to convict him. He was dealing with sophisticated banks. They were banks like many in New York that knew Trump was mendacious, that knew Trump was a grifter, and I think did some of their own due diligence, regardless of what he told them his properties were worth. So that is going to be a hurdle. On the other hand, I think there's a legal case to be made that his mere attempt to try to mislead may be damning enough. And I think those are some of the things that Tish James is going to have to convince a jury of. She doesn't have to show intent. She can introduce the fact that Donald and Eric both took the Fifth hundreds of times, and the jury can interpret that as a possible admission of guilt. You can't do that in a criminal suit. So she's got some leeway here with the jury. But at the end of the day, I do think it is this. The arc of the Trump family's life in New York City as developers and as business people could come to a very rocky and ugly close as the result of this lawsuit.
Suzanne, the arc is also a lie, though. I mean, your great reporting was captured in a documentary on Showtime that shows that if an arc goes like this, what was over here was all fake too. Let me show this sort of the family business, Trump's taxes, and the myth of being self-made.
The family did not want attention drawn to that sale. We spent months going through public records, just trying to figure out what was transferred and what the price was.
Where's the mortgage document, just so we've got it noted?
It's on the drive, yeah, okay, under property records, and then there's a separate folder for 220. Document.
And we started to realize not only was there that one big payday, there was dozens of streams of revenue from Fred to Donald.
So back to sort of the montage that I started at the beginning of this block, the whole thing was stagecrafted.
Well, let's start with the montage where, you know, Tim made the great point. He's not the biggest real estate developer in New York. You also just look at what was put up on that screen, Trump Ice, horrible business. It's no longer around. Taj Mahal, it's gone. Like, it just, I could keep going. And then you also have at the core of this, and he ran for president on this idea that he was a self-made billionaire, nothing could be further from the truth. He is the son of an incredibly successful real estate developer, Fred Trump, who he inherited hundreds of millions of dollars from. And just beyond that, Fred Trump propped Donald Trump up at every turn of his career, particularly when he was starting out. Donald Trump has talked about how he got a $1 million loan from his father, and he built that into an empire, and he has used that lie and told it to the American people and then said, you know, vote for me. And that's the sort of, you know, great imaginative thinking that I will bring to this country. And it's just all a lie.
It's just amazing. I want to read you, Harry, another poll from Tish James's lawsuit implicating the kids. They're not kids. The grown adults that are also being sued today. As executive vice presidents of the Trump Org, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump were also aware of and knowingly participated in the scheme. Indeed, the fraudulent scheme was integral to the business of the Trump Org and required the participation of Trump and his children. As executive vice presidents, the three children were intimately involved in the operation of the Trump Organization's business. They were aware of the true financial performance of the company, whether through Donald Trump Jr.'s work on commercial leasing, Ivanka Trump's work on Doral, Trump Chicago, and OPO, or Eric Trump's work on the golf course portfolio, which of course brought us the great revelation that they had all the money they needed from Russia. Is this the civil version of the kind of evidence that would be marshaled in a RICO investigation and prosecution?
Yeah, look, it's pretty close. And what would a RICO would show that they themselves were a criminal organization. But when what is this? It's the equivalent, but as to the Trump brand, which has always been so important to him and, of course, to his children. Basically, it's the entire business. People have noted this, but just to put a finer point on it, all the properties, Scotland, Florida, whatever, they're involved because he uses them in New York to inflate the value. So a lot of people are clamoring for Trump, the person, to be in an orange jumpsuit. May or may not ever happen, even if he's convicted. But to the extent Trump, the brand, has been, you know, equated with him as he's wanted it to, this is an absolute cannon shot against Trump, the brand. And I think it is basically indefensible on their part. Yes, there are some difficulties. Tim has just mentioned some burden of proof and the like. But I don't see how you bring this case to a jury. Just listen to what he said at the top of this segment here. A jury would loathe him. Put on top of that the lower burden of proof and the wildly inflated valuations. This is really an existential threat to what is second only to his physical person, and that is the Trump brand, now, in the past, and in history. This is, I would argue, the future is now, as it were. Everyone's waiting for things to start. I think given the kind of mortal threat this is to the brand itself, we are now in the period where a reckoning has begun.
The reckoning has begun. I have to sneak in a quick break, but I have 10,000 more questions for each of you off of that answer. Don't go anywhere. everyone is back. Tim, I want to ask you a question. There's this, I think, false caricature of Trump that he's somehow Putin-esque, and Putin's an ex-KGB agent that commands a nuclear arsenal. Trump is an ousted ex-president who was impeached twice, who's having bizarre movie screenings at Mar-a-Lago with anyone that will come. What do you think is actually happening right now?
Well, I mean, we know that Donald Trump right now is mired in a tar pit of lawsuits. He has a federal investigation of why he took state secrets to Mar-a-Lago and stuck them in a closet there. He now has Tish James's lawsuit as a threat to his business. The Manhattan DA still has a criminal investigation going. And I think there are federal investigations stemming from the January 6th committee revelations that he has yet to contend with if Merrick Garland follows through on the evidence trail. Whatever he might be saying in terms of bravado or a willingness to go on, he is someone who's always relished trench warfare. The reality is he's never been exposed on so many fronts legally. And I think there's a myth around the idea that he's been able to escape from absolutely everything. But the truth of it is that absolutely everything hasn't always landed on his doorstep, and now it has. And he may be screening movies at Mar-a-Lago and pretending to be blasé, but all of this has to be lurking in the back of his head in a very potent way.
Harry, you know, you look at the work that Tish James did. I'm not even going to dignify the responses that Trump had to her today, but they're beyond dog whistles. They're racist smears. You look at the work that Fani Willis has done in Georgia. What is the best way for us non-lawyers to understand why they seem to be out in front of DOJ?
Well, what they're doing is smaller. It's easier for Tish James to put together a civil lawsuit, and Fani Willis is focused only on what happened in Georgia. And second, you know, Merrick Garland, whom I've championed as against a lot of protests, there's a book at DOJ, and they're now looking at six or seven, and this is leaving alone Mar-a-Lago, discrete kind of offenses for the January 6th committee. That's a whole cluster of conduct that proves something about Trump. For the DOJ, those are individual exercises in proving of elements, consideration of what's on the other side, et cetera. So their DOJ by its own timeline is not being slow here. But I think it's really the you know, tighter and more discreet aspects of both the lawsuits. Look, Tish James today gave a referral to SDNY, but also to the Manhattan DA in criminal conduct. They haven't done anything yet. It's a bigger thing, especially with a non-user of email like Donald Trump, to stitch up something that you really feel is bulletproof that has to do with fraudulent intent.
Suzanne, quick last word.
Yeah. I just thinking, you didn't mention the IRS as well, and there's going to be a referral to the IRS. I mean, it does feel like, I mean, I need a spreadsheet to keep track of all this. I mean, it must be getting really, to Tim's point, there is just so much going on. And, you know, I'm very focused on the businesses, and this is just another mess. And the Trump Organization is going to trial in Manhattan in a month. You know, the Trump Organization and all of these things are going to have collateral consequences for the business. Will it be one or the other? You don't know what the tipping point is, and will there be a settlement? You don't know, but this is just, he's got a lot of bad headline news. There's just so much more. And you can't imagine, all of January 6th and everything that preceded it and everything that has come since has been bad for his businesses. And this is just horrible.
It's amazing.
I mean, they were losing so much money before, now, like, good luck, you know?
Doesn't make it any better. Suzanne Craig, Harry Lipman, Tim O'Brien, thank you so much for being part of our coverage. So grateful to all of you. When we come back, as the ex-president's problems continue to mount, the January 6th Select Committee is preparing for its public return next week. How the political and legal landscape has changed since we last heard from them. That's after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal at a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined. My guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
In our hearing tonight, you saw an American president faced with a stark and unmistakable choice between right and wrong. There was no ambiguity, no nuance. Donald Trump made a purposeful choice to violate his oath of office, to ignore the ongoing violence against law enforcement, to threaten our constitutional order. There is no way to excuse that behavior. It was indefensible. Our committee understands the gravity of this moment, the consequences for our nation. We have much work yet to do, and we will see you all in September.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. Those were the final words, the last words that we heard from the January 6th Select Committee's last public hearing. It was exactly 2 months ago today. A grave warning there about the threat posed by Donald Trump, his allies, and his supporters, who remain fueled and fired up by his lies. The threat they pose to our country endured, said Liz Cheney. Now, since she made those remarks, there has been an avalanche of staggering developments surrounding the twice impeached ex-president that bear out warnings like the one you just heard. Today's bombshell announcement by the New York Attorney General of her filing of a lawsuit against Trump, his three eldest children, and his business, accusing them of large-scale fraud and referring them to federal prosecutors and to the IRS. There was, of course, a monumental move last month by the FBI to search Mar-a-Lago for classified documents that the president took with him when he left office. It's a move that has landed him at the heart of a criminal investigation for possibly violating, among other things, the Espionage Act. We've also seen, since the 1-6 committee concluded its last public hearing, the big lie and election conspiracies seep even deeper into the Republican Party's DNA. Election deniers in key swing states like Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin won their respective GOP primaries. According to a recent analysis, 27 states now have election deniers running for governor, AG, or secretary of state, positions that oversee the administration of elections. There was also the expected but still significant primary loss by the committee's vice chair, Liz Cheney, in her race to keep her seat in Congress. Cheney's defeat was a direct result of her efforts to take down Trump for inciting an insurrection and trying to overturn his loss to President Joe Biden. We've also learned of massive escalations in the DOJ's probe into the efforts to overturn the 2020 election results, including that earlier this month, the Justice Department issued about 40 subpoenas to Trump aides and seized the phones of at least two top advisors. Additionally, reports revealed that among those complying with his subpoena is Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows. With all of that as the backdrop, the January 6th Select Committee is set to hold its next public hearing 1 week from today on September 28th. We are still awaiting an official locking in of that date and an official announcement. But since the committee is required to give a 7-day notice, we expect that sometime today. Chairman Benny Thompson noted this upcoming hearing will likely be the committee's last and said that it will focus on a theme the committee has not covered previously. It's where we begin the hour. Joining us, Congresswoman Madeleine Dean of Pennsylvania, who served as the House manager during Donald Trump's second impeachment. We were looking back at what the state of American democracy and politics and efforts to hold Trump accountable look like at the night of that last public hearing, and almost a sea change of really a deepening crisis. Your thoughts on the stakes and the work before this committee when they come back?
Well, I'm so proud of this committee, Nicole. You know that they've been at one thing, which is telling the truth to the American people who had been so broadly deceived by a former president who failed to win re-election and by those around him. You know, I've just come from the floor, Nicole. So in addition to all of what you just layered on, we here in Congress are doing our work as a result of what happened on January 6th and the events leading up to it. We just passed, or I just voted yes, along with my colleagues, to pass the Presidential Election Reform Act to clarify and make stronger the Electoral Count Act, which you saw become such a piece of fodder for President Trump, trying to convince the former Vice President Pence to overturn the electoral count. So we're doing our job here to put guardrails back up by way of legislation to an incredibly corrupt president. I've talked with Benny Thompson on the floor about the upcoming hearing. He confirmed the things that you are reporting, that there will be substantial video and there'll be substantial testimony. You know that they have interviewed more than 1,000 witnesses, and he expressed to me there are so many at very important levels of government or influence around the president. So I expect that this hearing, while it may be the last, and though, although he hasn't counted out future hearings based on more information constantly coming in, this will fit the exact pattern of what they've already done. Extraordinary work to reveal the truth. And note that most of the testimony that has been revealed, whether live or videotaped, has been from Republicans who wanted nothing more than Donald Trump to succeed. Of course, he failed miserably. His corrupt grifting has been revealed, and now we see all of these investigations closing in on the president.
Congresswoman, we have, by our count, just 9 Republicans voting for the Electoral Count Act. What about it could one be against?
I can't imagine. defining clearly that the vice president's job is ministerial. Maybe they didn't like the fact that in the bill we say that you can't just have one Josh Hawley or somebody say, I object. We actually tried to put more teeth into it so that objections would not be frivolous, baseless, and so corrupt as the ones that we suffered here and struggled through on January the 6th. It's good government. It's actually pushing back on the fact that the former president failed to win re-election and then tried to interfere with the peaceful transfer of power. But you saw that we only had 10 Republicans vote with us in terms of the article of impeachment. So sadly, mm-hmm. the other side of the aisle is guided by the man from Florida, a failed former president who cares only for himself, nothing for the Constitution or his oath or the people of this country.
Liz Cheney gave an interesting interview where she talked about Republicans knowingly signing on to the objections to President Joe Biden's win and almost muttering that the things they would do for Orange Jesus. If you step back and you take the deadly insurrection and the shredding of the Constitution out of it, it is almost funny to hear her and her sort of dry Cheney tone refer to what they call him, Orange Jesus. But when you put it into the context of the QAnon rally, or the QAnon sort of song playing at Trump's rally Saturday, the people holding up the finger, it feels like the brainwashing and the zombie nature of Trump supporters is now at a very obvious intersection with the threat of domestic violent extremism. Do you think it's time for, you know, I mean, it's overdue for a come to Jesus, but do you hold Republicans responsible if there is political violence in this country?
I certainly do. Anyone who incites their supporters to violence through lies and disinformation. I just came from a judiciary markup where election denying was present in that hearing from Republican members. You just used the expression, the deadly insurrection. They were actually taking criticism of that. What was so deadly about it? Who died there?
What?
They didn't want to acknowledge the deaths of the police officers, Brian Sicknick, and those who died, sadly, by suicide following the combat, where they worked to protect our lives. It was an outrageous set of comments that I'm about to return to. But when it was evidence that the election denying, the denying of the truth, has been so potent and so poisonous that these elected officials can't seem to bring themselves off it. I really invite them, and you should have heard the beautiful words of my colleague from New York, Mr. Jones, who invited them with compassion that it is not too late to turn to the truth and reveal that all of this has been lies, and it is lies that is so extraordinarily dangerous as to lead to violence, like we saw on January 6th and what others think could come and they actually want to come if Mr. Trump doesn't get his way. The indecency here is staggering. The fact that our democracy is on the line, they don't seem to notice work to care. I don't understand their weddedness to the extraordinarily corrupt and indecent criminal behavior of Donald Trump.
Congresswoman Madeleine Dean, thank you very much for starting us off this hour.
Thank you.
Let's bring in some of our favorite reporters and friends to this conversation. Washington Post Congressional Investigations reporter Jackie Alemany is back. Also joining us, Barbara McQuaid, former U.S. attorney, now law professor at the University of Michigan. And our friend Tim Miller is back, writer at large for The Bulwark, all three MSNBC contributors. Jackie, what are you looking for? What should we be looking ahead to from the 1-6 committee? What do they mean when they say they're going to cover a topic they haven't covered yet?
I'm not quite sure yet, Nicole, and that is a question that we've been asking our sources all this week and last week, and to no avail, obviously, though, otherwise we would have reported it. But what one source said to me, although this is pretty vague and nonspecific, is that if you think of the first season of hearings that we saw from the January 6th committee over the summer as what Trump did, that they would then view the upcoming, at the time this person was referring to, hearings. Now, right now, at least there's only one hearing tentatively scheduled, that they would look at this hearing as Trump's intent, what he was trying to do and what he was thinking of while he was trying to do those things. Sort of getting a little bit more inside his head, adding some more analysis and putting it in the context of what it means for our current political environment and what it has, the damage and sort of corrosive hold it has taken on Republican politics going forward, and how those implications are. I know we've used this term before, but how the insurrection has sort of been a slow rolling insurrection and has continued in real time with this new slate of election deniers, many of whom have won their primaries and might even be serving in Congress in the 118th Congress starting in January.
It's so amazing to think about how impactful the public hearings were in their, as you said, Jackie, the summer series of public hearings, and yet how much the world has changed since the last one. I mean, a judge found probable cause to authorize a search of Mar-a-Lago. 27 states are looking at election deniers for either the top executive of their state, the top law enforcement official, or the top the Secretary of State job. You now have, you know, real serious legal threats to his business empire. I feel squeamy calling it an empire. But I wonder, Barbara, how you sort of evaluate the stakes in terms of this committee's singular ability to turn the country's attention to Trump's misconduct.
Well, in many ways, Nicole, Trump is his misconduct serves as a distraction for his misconduct. it's difficult to focus on because of all the other distractions, but you can't ignore any of them, right? You don't say, well, we're just going to not worry about these classified documents at Mar-a-Lago because we don't want to detract from our work on January 6th, or we're going to ignore $250 million worth of fraud in New York because of what's going on in January 6th. But I think every player has to keep their eye on the ball. Everybody's kind of playing in a different way and needs to focus on that. And these things are very, very bad. The Mar-a-Lago documents are very bad. $250 million in fraud is very bad. These allegations are awful. But there's nothing worse in my mind than trying to overturn a presidential election. And for that reason, I think the January 6th committee needs to make sure that they resume where they left off. They had a lot of momentum going in terms of holding this president accountable. And so I think I have every expectation that they will do just what they did in the prior hearings, making them very compelling, using a lot of media to make it engaging and to tell the story. And I think there are pieces of this story we haven't heard yet. The extent to which the big fraud was the big lie was also the big ripoff that we've heard some hints about. And I also think connecting up Donald Trump to those who used force at the Capitol on January 6th, the seditious conspiracy. Can you make that link? And I'll be looking for those links and from the January 6th committee when they resume these hearings.
Tim, Asha Rangappa tied the Mar-a-Lago conduct under scrutiny to the big lie in a way that really sort of gave me my, aha. She said, the defense around taking, packing, keeping, and then lying about returning highly classified documents at Mar-a-Lago is all predicated on, and you heard this yesterday in Judge Deary's courtroom, they still call him the president. He's not the president. He's a twice impeached ex-president who was a failure on every count. But anything else, he's not the president. He's not President Trump. He's former President Trump. The tie between his criminal conduct there and the lie that is inciting his supporters to hold up a finger and sway to mood music that was played under Trump's remarks. I think that was the first time music played while he was talking. I've watched a lot of Trump rallies. I've never seen that before. And you also have someone who died trying to attack and shoot up an FBI field office. Frank Figluzzi calls it a death count, a Trump death count. What do you make of the committee's opportunity to tie all of these threats in the country, active threats to the FBI because of Trump's response, Trump's continued delusions and mainlining to his supporters, these subtle and not so subtle lies about still being the president and having the right to declassify, and the work specifically in the scope of the 1-6 committee investigation?
Well, if Jackie, and I trust that Jackie has about the best sources around over there on the Hill, if we're talking about getting to intent, I do think that it relates. And you can't just separate all of these things. Donald Trump's lack of respect for our institutions, for the rule of law, for what his obligations were as president, as it relates to the documents that he brought to Mar-a-Lago, are quite similar to, or obviously just of a piece, really, more with his lack of respect for the democratic institutions that he tried to undermine in this election and going all the way back to when he got into the race. So I do think that's an important part of the story for the January 6th committee to tell. I think the other thing to just remember, though, is that part is kind of the narrative part, which I think is an important part of their work, right? Making sure people understand the threats. I think another is the action part of it. And we're seeing some of the action part of this right now coming out of the January 6th committee. They're having a vote over in the House on the Electoral Count Act reform. This is something where, you know, we never expected to have a president like Donald Trump who wouldn't give a rip about the way that we have a transition of power, that we'd have to think about, oh, we need to update this 1800s law about how we transition power. It didn't occur to anybody throughout the 1900s. This was something that needed to be updated because we never assumed there'd be somebody like Donald Trump that was in the White House that tried to, you know, look for any nook and cranny he could to hold on to power. So now they're trying to update that law right now in the House. And as we were coming on, what had happened, only the impeachers and one additional House Republican was voting for this just common sense reform to make it more clear, to avoid loopholes, to avoid, you know, having an opportunity like something like January 6th. And that is where the entire Republican Party is right now. They're so enthralled to him that they're unwilling to even do the basics to safeguard our democracy, because who knows, maybe he'll have another chance in 2024 and try to undermine it again, and they would want to support him again. So I think that what the committee has to do going into this fall is both of those things: make that case, tie the room together, if you will, between all of his different insurrectionist and extra legal behaviors, and also, you know, try to get some of these recommendations passed and hopefully through the House and the Senate while the Democrats are in charge.
All right, no one's going anywhere today. There's much more to get into as the January 6th committee gets ready to return to center stage again after months of growing legal peril for the ex-president. Later in the hour, President Joe Biden's harsh and historic rebuke of Russia today as he sought to rally the United Nations in support of Ukraine. It comes as Vladimir Putin is making some very alarming moves to escalate the war with potentially unfathomable consequences. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
going to speak with the vice president or President Trump? Are you guys making any decisions on that yet?
No, we are still in communications with the vice president's attorney, but we've not talked, to my knowledge, to the president,
the former president. You're 2 months to the midterms, and you have made decisions. Two pretty significant witnesses.
Well, you know, we have a lot of information, and so we're not certain if they will come, but significance in your mind, but we have testimony from a lot of witnesses as to what they know. The vice president and president would be an addition, but it wouldn't determine the ultimate outcome of the report.
We're back. Jackie, how much of this is to say they offered them an opportunity to talk? And how much of this is real? I mean, what do they need to know from either of them? They have absolutely encircled both men with their closest advisors.
Yeah, I think that there is a feeling that having Vice President, former Vice President Pence come in and potentially former President Donald Trump lends a certain credibility to the investigation. That there's also, you know, the fact that I think that there's a need to at least check off the box to formally invite these two men potentially because they were such integral parts of the efforts to overturn the results of the election. But again, there has been a consistent desire to get Pence on the stand himself to retell and recount the pressure campaign himself. As we've seen throughout the past several months in these public hearings, even though a lot of this information has already been public for quite some time now, there's nothing that's been more powerful than hearing it firsthand from witnesses, targets, and people who were the targets of the efforts to overturn the election themselves, hearing it straight from the mouth of Cassidy Hutchinson and what was going on in the White House that day. And I think there's also the recognition that hearing it from Pence, despite the great detail that his top advisors have provided in extensive depositions behind closed doors, but also during these public hearings, we heard from Greg Jacob, his counsel, who was going back and forth with John Eastman before and after the actual attack on the Capitol about getting Pence to try to intervene and return the results of the elections. That hearing it from Pence himself is just it's a bit of a game changer. I know Benny Thompson says it's not, and I don't think it changes the essence of the report, the recommendations, and what we're ultimately going to see put out. But I do think if you want max impact, max eyeballs on this final hearing, and the best way to do that is with these two players themselves.
I mean, Barbara, I'm trying to envision it. You know, Mike Pence, were you ever afraid for your life? No. Why were you in the basement? I mean, you know, Mike Pence, what did he say on you? You on the phone. Did he call you the P word? Ooh, I've never heard that word. I mean, what does he can't go testify because one, you can't lie before Congress. And two, he wants to be president too badly to tell the truth.
Yeah. And I think I might disagree with Jackie here. I think for that reason, maybe at the end of the day, the committee does not want him to come forward. He is not going to be the kind of witness who is helpful in a case. You know, it's sort of like when a prosecutor thinks about having a witness who is being cooperative and is getting credit for their cooperation, and they have an incentive to tell the story in a fulsome way versus someone who is there only pursuant to a subpoena who will answer questions as if you're pulling their teeth. You know, you might get a yes, you might get a no, but you're not going to get a lot of elaboration. In some ways, you could kind of damage the impression of what we currently have, having heard from his aides, a very realistic view about just how dire that situation was that day and what the role of Donald Trump was and what the role of Mike Pence was. Now, I do think he would need to testify in a criminal case because you need firsthand witnesses in that scenario. And so maybe that's the place where we hear his story, because there were some conversations where only he was the other party to it. People may have heard one end of the phone conversation, but he's the only one who heard both ends of a conversation. And in a criminal trial, you need firsthand observers to be able to testify to what they saw. But I don't know that he adds that much to the story that the committee is telling. And I think he could harm their case if he decides to try to, you know, mitigate what happened or minimize anyone's role here.
Tim, I think, I don't know where he opines, but he either Truth Social or did some interview where he said, that if he ran for president, he would never pick Mike Pence again, because when he had to vote, he voted the wrong way. I mean, Trump is just squashing Pence. And if he had, you know, a backbone, he would go out and just tell the truth with no agenda. But I don't think that's who Pence is. Do you?
Well, no, Pence has no backbone, and he's totally owned by Trump. But I guess I just have to have a contrary view than what some of the rest of the folks on the panel have said, in that I just think that the facts of the case are so bad for Donald Trump that no matter what Mike Pence tried to do to wiggle out of them, and he's not that skilled, he would have to at least speak to the basic facts. And having the former vice president of the United States, just for example, testify to the fact that he had to be the one to call the National Guard in when our Capitol was under siege because the president was sitting in the kitchen watching the Super TiVo. I mean, that's, I think, a pretty big moment, both politically, historically, for the committee. And so I don't know. I understand the reticence, the feeling that Mike Pence might try to, you know, undermine the committee in some way to get some credit with the base that's never going to love him. He might try that, but Liz Cheney has proven to be very skilled, and I think that she could ask him very narrowly tailored questions that would make the former president look awful, because the facts are awful for the former president, and having the vice president there would be a really big primetime moment. And I think, frankly, Pence should feel obligated, putting the politics of this aside, Pence should feel obligated to testify, to live up to his own oath. Maybe he doesn't, and maybe he won't, but I don't think we should just let him off the hook by assuming that he won't, because the politics will be bad for him in a Republican primary that he's never going to win. So I would have liked to, maybe I'm in the minority on this, but I would have liked to have seen more pressure put on Pence by the committee to testify and by others to testify, and because I think that it's important that he does, though I don't expect that he will.
It's important for us to hear all that. Jackie Alamany, Barbara McQuaid, Tim Miller, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Shifting gears for us here to the war in Ukraine. Today, the United Nations President Joe Biden delivered a strong condemnation of Russia at a time when Moscow is looking to escalate its brutal war against the Ukrainian people. We'll show you what the president said and what might happen next.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Let us speak plainly. A permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase a sovereign state from the map. Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. No more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force. This world should see these outrageous acts for what they are. Putin claims he had to act because Russia was threatened. But no one threatened Russia, and no one other than Russia sought conflict. This war is about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, plain and simple, and Ukraine's right to exist as a people. Whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever you believe, that should make your blood run cold.
That was President Joe Biden earlier today speaking in front of the United Nations, forcefully condemning Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin, for its cruel and unjust war against Ukraine. The speech by President Biden was a rarity for an American president to give before the UN General Assembly. It was aimed directly at and immensely critical of one country while seeking to rally the world at large to stand beside Ukraine and returning to a theme so common in his presidency, this battle between democracy and autocracy. President Biden's powerful speech today comes amid a flurry of moves from Vladimir Putin as he seeks to avoid further embarrassment and as Russia continues to falter on the battlefield. Today, in a rare address to the Russian people, Putin announced that he would call up 300,000 new troops to the front lines as Ukraine continues to take back territory from Russia. Putin reserved most of the blame for the U.S. and for Europe, accusing them of nuclear blackmail while renewing fears of possible retaliation with nuclear weapons. Putin said this, quote, in the face of a threat to the territorial integrity of our country, to protect Russia and our people, we will certainly use all the means at our disposal. This is not a bluff. I will emphasize this again, with all the means at our disposal. Joining our coverage, Helene Cooper, New York Times Pentagon correspondent and an MSNBC contributor. And with us at the table at long last, NBC News correspondent Carol Lee. Carol, tell me about the making of this speech and whether there are policy goals or whether it was to sort of fire everybody up to continue to stand with Ukraine.
It was more of the latter. I mean, there needs to be a policy behind and commitments behind rallying people. But this was a speech that was really designed for the president to isolate Putin. He did it right from the beginning of his speech, saying that the war in Ukraine is responsible for just is the responsibility of just one man. And then again, said that only one man can really end this. And that's obviously not what Russia wants to do right now. So there was this effort to really isolate Putin, isolate Russia, and then call on all of the leaders, some of whom were in the room, some who weren't, but all the members of the United Nations, and say, we need to do something here. And so the goal is to keep everybody united against Russia and for Ukraine. And you heard the president very specifically say to the UN, you know, you need to do more. This is a country that has a very prominent seat on the UN Security Council. One of five permanent members has veto power. And they're violating everything it is that the United Nations says it stands for. And so it was a bit of a mix of isolating the Russians further and also a rallying cry and saying that everybody needs to stick with this. Because one of the concerns that the administration has is as this drags on, as the war goes into winter, and there's all sorts of concerns about that, that people will start to look away.
Right. And the economic pressures will override the stalwart support. Helene. The UN, I'll be as generous as I can, is not known for making any moves ever about much of anything in terms of a conflict that involves a member of the Security Council. I mean, the chances that this speech will move anyone are very slim. And so to Carol's point, this really was almost about shaming anyone on the fence to continue to stand with Ukraine as Putin turns into like a cartoon character of a Russian villain. I will use my nukes. Don't you doubt me. This is not a bluff. I mean, it's cartoonish, the things he said today.
It really is. Hi, Nicole. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. The fact that that Vladimir Putin is using these like not very veiled at all nuclear threats is not really surprising anymore. We've come to expect this from him this year. This isn't the first time that he's done it. This is the most explicit that he's been, but he is, let's face it, and you both alluded to that just now. He just got beat in the last 2 weeks, embarrassingly so. His troops ran away. The troops were in full retreat in the northeast, where they weren't expecting this Ukrainian like lightning strike. They've underperformed from day one of this special military operation. And his announcement now that he is calling up 300,000 more troops is his effort to try to impose some sort of will on a really chaotic war that has blown up in his face. But it's also an acknowledgement from him, whether he says so or not, is an acknowledgement of just the abject failure of the Russian military so far. So for President Biden, no, you don't go to the UN to try to get to shore up support for Ukraine. You're never going to get that there, because so many of the countries in the UN, because of its the size of it, you have countries who have other interests that they must weigh. Countries in the third world, people in Africa, countries in Asia, they are all making their own calculations. For President Biden, where he needs to make sure that he continues to have unity is Europe and with NATO. And so far he's got that, but that's where I would be a little bit more worried if I were him. Pay a lot of attention to what the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said today. He had very strong words today at the UN about Germany and about Russia and about Germany continuing to back the sanctions and continuing to stand up to Ukraine. But that's where we need to be looking at as winter comes in the next few months, as heating price, you know, the energy prices soar, and you see Europeans starting to shiver and having to choose, God forbid, between whether they'll have heat or whether they'll eat. And that's where the rubber is going to hit the road when you start talking about international unity against Ukraine. But for Putin right now, his back is very much to the wall, and he's calling up reinforcements.
Carol, what is happening with President Biden that we're not seeing? I mean, are there these kinds of meetings that Helene's talking about with our friends to try to gird them for the winter ahead?
Well, that's one of the things that the administration sees as beneficial for having the UN General Assembly in person for the first time in a couple of years. We know he had a one-on-one scheduled meeting, it was public, with the new British Prime Minister, but he also had a pull aside. That's what phrase is for, you know, two leaders.
It's a totally planned, casual, spontaneous bump in.
Yeah. They just happen to see each other in the hallway and with three aides.
Yeah. Translators.
On each side, yeah, and interpreters. So he had a pull aside with Macron of France. And it was notable that an official in that meeting deals with energy issues for the administration. And so, to Helene's point, this is a huge concern. And from the White House's perspective, they feel, and the president feels, like they've done well so far in terms of maintaining that unity. But this is going to be the real test. And the longer this goes on, the harder it gets. And that's one of the reasons why you see the U.S., you know, part of this is leading by example. So the president will announce a new tranche of aid, a significant amount of aid. There are still things the U.S. has not committed to that the Ukrainians want. It'll be interesting to see if they do move on some of that stuff in the coming weeks. But you see them trying to take steps to figure this out and make sure that everybody sticks together to the extent they can.
Helene and Carol are sticking around. Ukraine's President Zelensky is addressing the UN right now. We'll try to turn some of that around for you and play it for you on the other side of a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Dear Mr. President of the General Assembly, dear Secretary General of the United Nations, dear heads of states and governments, dear journalists, nations of the world, Ukraine wants peace. Europe wants peace. The world wants peace. And we have seen who is the only one who wants war. There is only one entity among all UN member states who would say now, if he could interrupt my speech, that he's happy with this war, with his war. But we will not let this entity prevail over us.
That was Ukrainian President Zelensky. That was the beginning of his speech just a few moments ago. He's either still giving that speech or it has just wrapped up in front of the United Nations General Assembly. Helene, Zelensky is the X factor. I mean, this has all gone differently than what anyone in the United States government thought would happen at the beginning of the war because of that one man. Will you talk about how he's moved U.S. foreign policy?
He really has. I mean, he's by virtue of his charisma, his steadfastness, his refusal to run. I think, you know, you recall the United States had just come out of that very brutal and painful extraction from Afghanistan. And they'd watched this Afghan national government that we had supported for 20 years collapse and the government flee. And so when this war started, people were not sure. I think American policymakers, the American military officials, Biden administration officials have been scarred by Afghanistan. And the expectation was that the Ukrainian government would collapse fairly quickly, that the Russian troops would be to Kyiv within a week, that, you know, you maybe see a rump state, Ukrainian state, and we'd end up in a situation where we're backing an insurgency, but where Russia would have successfully managed to invade. You remember that video that Zelensky put out, like, I think it was in the first 3 or 4 days of the invasion, where it's nighttime and he's out there with a bunch
in the flak jacket.
People were on Instagram and stuff, putting it on TikTok, putting that to rap music. I mean, they looked like really like a bunch of guys that you'd be willing to follow. They were, and he kept saying, "I am here," and he listed the names of the officials behind him. The mayor of Kyiv is here, and it's that stick. We are here, and we're going to stay, and we're not going to be run out of our country. We're going to stay and fight, and that's what he's done for the last 7 months. 7 months now, and extraordinarily well, like shockingly well. I spoke with an American, a senior American military official this morning, who was talking about just how surprised the Pentagon remains at the Ukrainian military's ability to persevere and to push forward. And they all say that at this point, nobody at the Pentagon is betting against Ukraine in this war.
And it is such a shift. I mean, how much visibility do we have into the personal relationship between Biden and Zelensky?
Well, look, it wasn't, you know, early on when Russia was amassing the troops on the border, there was, and Zelensky was saying things out loud, and he had said things publicly that would sort of,
he didn't want all that intel out there.
Head scratching. And there was a lot of frustration within the administration with him and how he was comporting himself. And there was the sense that he wasn't being realistic outwardly to the public. And even if he was a little more realistic in private conversations, they weren't entirely happy with him, and that just switched. And what we've seen is a Pentagon and a White House that has at times been reluctant to give things to the Ukrainians, to Zelensky, when he's asking for them. And then they get pushed, and Congress has played a huge role in that, including Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. And then they give them what they're asking for, and then they are successful. And so it keeps sort of feeding on itself. One interesting thing about Zelensky's comments is he sounded very similar in terms of the message that Biden had, which is that this is all happening. There's only one person who likes what happens here, and that's Vladimir Putin.
No, it's amazing the way Zelensky has driven the conversation, including here at home. Helene Cooper, Carol Lee, a pleasure to see both of you. Thank you so much. Another break for us. We'll be right back. Today, United States Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman appeared in a Washington courtroom to testify against QAnon member Doug Jensen, who can be seen here chasing Officer Goodman up the stairs in the U.S. Capitol during the January 6th insurrection. Goodman told the court he felt threatened and said, quote, "I felt like they were going to rush at any time." And he provided a fuller picture of the horrors of that day, describing being hit in the head, targeted and overpowered by rioters, and sprayed in the face with bear spray. All of it before the now infamous stairway chase even began. It comes as the disgraced ex-president who incited those rioters is now fully and publicly embracing the dangerous right-wing conspiracy theory QAnon, appearing at an Ohio rally this weekend wearing a QAnon pin and playing a song that sounded a whole lot like the QAnon theme song. We will be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We are grateful.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.